at Capterra.com.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lurie. Well, Florida school teachers have been losing ground when it comes to pay over the last 10 years. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And how well is Pinellas County preparing for the changing demographics in the county that in about 30 years will make whites only 50% of the population in Pinellas? We'll talk about that later on in the program. First up, the National Education Association has just released its annual report on teachers' salaries across the nation. The study found that Florida ranks near the bottom, 46th among all the states in average teacher pay, and only $1,200 ahead of the lowest-ranked state of all, Mississippi. Florida ranks $40,000 behind the best-paying state for teachers on average. That state is New York. Lily Eskelson-Garcia is president of the 3-million-member National Education Association, and I spoke with President Garcia earlier today.
Let me tell you what we do every spring. Every time my lungs fill with cherry blossoms, I know it's time for us to release the rankings and estimates of salaries for teachers. This is the gold standard report that we do every year at the National Education Association, and we are alarmed at what we're seeing nationwide, and it's playing out in Florida as well. We are seeing the growing gap between teaching and our competition. Let me explain. Our competition is every other similarly educated, similarly experienced professional, where you need a college degree, it costs you this much to go to college and get your degree. If you're an accountant, if you're in technology, and a college student looking to say, where do I want to spend my career? We've had people that say, I feel a calling to teach. I feel like this is where I want to put my talent and my energy. And then they look in Florida at a starting salary of $37,636. Your average salary in Florida ranks 46th in the nation, 46 out of 50. Is what we have in Florida. And for some college student to say, I am going to be paying off a student loan and making $37,000 on average, there are some districts in Florida that pay a lot less than that. They have their parents saying, please don't be a teacher. It's wonderful, important work, but you'll be living in the basement till you're 42 paying off that student loan. You'll be having to hold down an extra job or maybe two for that starting salary. So that pay gap is growing. I am convinced as a woman teacher who taught 20 years in Utah elementary school, fourth, fifth, and sixth grade, that I also look at the gender gap of my profession. I still belong to a profession that is 76% women. We get patted on the head a lot. We get told we do important work, and we rarely get the professional respect. There is a respect gap that comes with that pay gap. And so for that and many other reasons, we know that this isn't just going to get better all by itself. It's why we organize. It's why teachers are part of their union and have that voice that says we will not be ignored, we will not be disrespected. And this is important information as we send this out to legislators, governors, advocates for schools and for children. And certainly we want our own members to know that depending on where you live, you can make a case for the fact that people will not want to be teachers. They will not be attracted to this. They won't stay in this profession, and that ultimately hurts students.
I see in your report where over the last 10 years, if you look at salaries in Florida adjusted for inflation, teachers have lost 12% in their actual pay on average in Florida since 2009. Here in Florida, we've got a shortage of teachers this year. Sometimes if you go to schools, you see help wanted signs outside the school.
Mm-hmm.
Next year, we're going to have a shortage of 7,000 unfilled teacher positions here in Florida. Is that tied to the low pay?
It is absolutely tied to low pay. And you can talk to any business person. You can talk to anyone with common sense and say, does what you pay someone, what kind of salary you can offer someone, have anything to do with who wants to work in that profession? Of course it does. But there's two things. I mean, none of us, not one teacher got into teaching to get rich. That is, I think, understood. But we also didn't expect to have to pay out of our own pockets, as all of us do, for our own supplies, for things that I didn't have a supply budget for my sixth graders. So I had to go down to the grocery store and the arts and crafts store and get science supplies and art supplies and sometimes paper, sometimes just paper for my kids because I didn't have that. We have teachers now that will go down to Costco and buy boxes of breakfast bars because they have kids that come to school hungry. We love someone else's child. We love them, and we are going to sacrifice for them, whether it's in our paycheck or what we might have to take out of our own pockets to buy for them. But what we know is this, you can only do this so long before you realize that you're being exploited and that your students are being neglected. And it seems to be a plan. It's not just that it's not appreciated. For a lot of the people that make those decisions on funding our schools, on basic funding, they're saying, well, look, you know, we just hire fewer teachers and put more kids in a classroom so that there's 40 or 45 kids in a class. They'll make it work, and we won't supply them with technology and paper and pencils and books. The teachers will make do. We'll lay off the school nurses and we'll give all the teachers a box of Band-Aids. They can be the school nurses. They can be the counselors. They can be the school psychologists. It only goes so far before enough is enough.
Is there a connection between teacher pay and outcome, though? Can you point to where teachers are better paid around the country and seeing better educational outcomes?
What the word outcome usually means is test scores, which I would argue till the day I die, that test scores tell us very, very little about what our children know and are really able to do. What we know is that where there have been movements to really say we are going to give our teachers professional pay, and not only that, but professional authority. We really want them to be creative. We want them to be leaders in their school. In places where they have had movements of what is now being called community schools, where parents and teachers and administrators and sometimes even the business community in that school area, where they come together and they say, what do our kids need in this school? How are we going to serve them? How are we going to come together to solve problems? Where teachers feel like they are the respected problem solvers and that their expertise is used and valued. That's where we've seen kids, where there have been high dropout rates, where the dropout rates disappear, where there have been things like fights and discipline problems disappear. We've seen it time and time again, where you unleash the power of a caring professional to organize a learning community. Magic happens. And that's where kids start to see the relevance in their education. And yes, guess what? Test scores do go up organically. It will happen because they stay in school. They show up. And it is something that we're seeing across the board. Respect for that teacher. Respect in the pay they receive is fundamental. But respect in their voice and their valued opinion is just as important.
And one last question, President Garcia, and that is, you know, people look at teachers and say, well, you work from maybe August to June or September to June. You got 2 months off. You can always get a part-time job in the summertime to supplement that low pay. What do you say to folks who say that?
Well, they don't say it when they're standing real close to me because the work that, because I will go off on somebody, the work that a teacher does is really 24/7. The papers you take home to grade, the planning you have to do. Now, more and more websites of teachers where parents can say, I need to know this, I had a question about that. We're up on the computer all night long answering parents' questions and connecting them and engaging them with what's happening with their individual children as we have more and more individual children in a single classroom. And through the summer, it is usually our professional development that we are required to engage in for our own improvement in our skills. If you are looking pound for pound, hour for hour, day for day, what a teacher does, you know that we're not sitting around eating bonbons with our feet up on the coffee table. We are out there working for our students, even through those summer months, and even through the second and third jobs that we have to hold down often to make ends meet.
Well, Lily Eskelson Garcia of the National Education Association, thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, that was Lily Eskelson Garcia, president of the National Education Association. She's based in Washington, D.C. And that report also shows that the starting national teacher pay has decreased by 3.1% nationwide when adjusted for inflation over the past 10 years. The highest average teacher salaries again in 2017-2018, New York State, $84,000. The lowest teacher salary, Mississippi, about just under $45,000. Florida was 46th in the nation, near the bottom in average teacher pay. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. There's another new study out about our economy, this one looking locally at Pinellas County and how well that county is preparing for big demographic changes by the middle part of this century. By 2050, only about half of Pinellas County will be made up of whites. Latinos, blacks, mixed race, Native American, and Asian Americans will make up the rest of the population. Right now, black and Hispanic residents lag behind their counterparts when it comes to income, education, and other quality of life measures. The county's future success and prosperity will depend on how well these groups of color do in the coming years. The study looking at changing demographics and how it will impact the Pinellas economy was done by a group called Unite Pinellas, and its executive director, Tim Dutton, joins us right now. Tim, nice to meet you. Thanks for coming over to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Rob. I appreciate it. I appreciate the invitation, too.
So tell me about Unite Pinellas. What is it?
Well, Unite Pinellas is a collective of predominantly organizations. There's the government and there's nonprofit sector as well as philanthropy, and with the intention of looking at issues that relate to equity, fairness and justice, if you will, in the entire county as opposed to one municipality, but the entire county.
There are some alarm bells in this study that you've done for Pinellas County, and I think one of the biggest alarm bells is the wealth gap, that because of the way people of color are treated and in some ways due to their own circumstances, there is a big gap in Pinellas County.
Yeah, and wealth is really the major indicator of success in terms of, in contrast to income. Wealth has to do with, so how much money do you have available if you have a crisis, or how much money can you draw upon if you want to send your kids to school. Now, the big issue we would argue is that this is a consequence, this gap is a consequence of history and of policies that were generated some a long time ago, and frankly, some several hundred years ago. This year, 2019, is the 400th anniversary of when the first slaves came to the United States. And frankly, some of those policies go back 200 or 300 years that started the policy impact on wealth differential. At that time, it was predominantly predominantly African-American, but now, in today's life, it's also other races and ethnicities.
Hmm. How big, if we didn't have racial discrimination or, just the thumb on the scale for people of color, how much would wealth increase in Pinellas County?
Well, it's... We worked with an organization called Policy Link, which is a national organization that focuses exclusively on issues of equity. And they do a calculation, and their calculation to your question is, so what if there were no inequity fundamentally? What if that were to go away? Their calculation indicates that the economy in Pinellas County would be $3.6 billion larger. Now, let's unpack that a little bit, because what they're really getting at is that the strengths and brilliance and skills of people who are now more or less left out of the economy or marginalized would be become a part of the economy. And those... that is a pretty hefty amount. Nationally, their calculation is we're talking about $14 trillion bigger national economy if, in fact, issues of equity were to be resolved, or inequity, actually.
A lot of people who happen to be white blame people of color for the circumstances that people of color find themselves in. And I'm sure you've heard this over and over again. What do you say to folks who say, well, it's their choice. It's their lifestyle. It's what they've done not to better themselves.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So the I know that there's always a component of everything in life that has to do with personal choice. At the same time, if you look at the history of our country, especially the last 75 to 100 years, there have been a series of policies that have diminished the opportunities that certain ethnic and racial groups have to economic and social success. And I'll be glad to mention of those.
Well, what are those? Because I think you're pointing at especially some of the changes that happened in the 30s as the country was trying to get through the Depression. Tell us what those policies are.
Yeah, and there's a series of them, but the ones that sort of stick out for me anyway are if you go back and look at the Social Security Act of 1935, great idea, and really made a big difference, especially to older adults. At the same time, explicitly exempted from coverage under the Social Security Act were occupations that were predominantly held by African Americans at that time. That was agricultural workers and domestic workers. And what happened, and that didn't get resolved for decades, what happened then is that the older adults that benefited from Social Security had a little bit of wealth to pass on to their family members. Those who didn't, and in this case predominantly African Americans who had jobs that focused on domestic work or agriculture workers, they didn't have that wealth to pass on. So wealth starts showing up even in something like the Social Security Act. In addition, however, Rob, it's more than just that particular one, the Social Security Act. There are a couple others that I'd like to mention. I'm rifling through my notes here.
And one of them I want to bring up is redlining, and that is the practice of banks of not lending to housing mortgages for particular sections of cities. Yep. And this not just in Pinellas County, but nationwide. This was a problem in the 40s, 50s, 60s, yep. Early 70s.
Really was resolved, allegedly resolved in 1968 with the Fair Housing Act. At the same time, and let's talk a little bit about what redlining is and where it came from. It was the idea came whenever the federal government wanted to create through the Federal Housing Administration They wanted to help subsidize housing development. And they did that, a good idea, because at that point, the idea of a family owning their home was really important from the standpoint of success of that for that family. And it really became an ethic, if you will, of the country. Home ownership is still considered to be essential, and we'll talk a little bit about how it is. But the Federal Housing Administration that subsidized these developments did so with the provision that the developers of those developments would only have the houses sold to white families. And furthermore, that each home sale had covenants attached to the sale that would make it so that the resale was not able to be done to families who weren't white. So in the process of doing that, they contracted with a company to go around the country and start drawing maps of just about all the major metropolitan areas and many even smaller ones. In fact, that's true of our community here, Pinellas County, Hillsborough County, all have these maps back from decades ago. And they drew red. The red part of the map was always the section that they said is not investable. And those were always where the African-American neighborhoods were. And that's where the term redlining came from.
Housing is a major way to transfer wealth from one generation to another. When the parents die and they sell their house, the kids get get the value of the house and then are able to put a major down payment on their new house.
That's right.
At least many times this happens in the white community, not always in the black community.
Well, explanation that you mentioned in terms of redlining is really the reason multi-generationally home ownership and it shows up in this report in Pinellas County is just about exactly half in the African American community than it is in the white community, and this goes all the way back to the policies that took place in that era of that the federal government promoted. So what we have, Social Security Act, this Federal Housing Administration actions, and by the way, redlining, not in the traditional sense, but there's a lot of reports out now that that the discriminatory lending practices that were supposed to be taken care of by this 1968 Housing Act, but then started showing up again in subprime loans in the before the Great Recession, 2008-ish. There's a recent report that says that in fact there is redlining back again with how mortgage discrimination, and there's a handful of counties in Florida. Neither Pinellas nor Hillsborough have been identified this way, but Alachua County is identified as an area where redlining is back again. They call it redlining, but really is discriminatory lending practices. So we have these two major forms of policy that, as you're saying, home ownership is the most classic and the largest way of transferring wealth. And as I mentioned before, it's not just the wealth transfer between generations. It's also the fact that when you own a home, you have an asset that has value, and your net wealth. You might think of it as what you can draw upon whenever you have a rainy day that some emergency strikes. Well, that's much less available to families of color. And in addition to that, in this country, only 44%, that's a number from the Federal Reserve Bank, of families in this country can find $400 if they need it tomorrow. So what that tends to do is it tends to make it very difficult on people who don't have a net wealth of any consequence to find emergency solutions, solutions to emergencies, basically. And those can show up in terms of health. Everybody has these kind of problems. They can show up in terms of health. They can show up in terms of, not having a car that breaks down so that you can't get to work, all those kinds of ways. So these start becoming really important. And then you see such solutions as things like the alternative financial systems, you know, things like payday loans and that kind of stuff. These were policy generated differences to opportunity that are continuing to get reinforced even in today's environment.
Well, we're talking with Tim Dutton. He is the executive director of a group called Unite, which is a coalition of nonprofits in Pinellas County. They're looking at what's going to happen in 2050 when a majority of people in Pinellas County are people of color and the whites begin to become the minority in the year 2050. What are the economic hurdles that we face as a community to try to make sure that economically we're prosperous? And our phone number is 813-239-9663.
The whole issue of the change in population that you mentioned, Rob, is contributes to the importance of this. Our frame on this, however, is that there is a component of this that relates to how the economy would be bigger if everybody were participating. We mentioned that earlier. But also there's this concept of, so how do we create systems that are fair and just for everybody? And so what happens is those organizations, those companies, frankly, that are paying attention to things like population and demographic change, they're thoughtful about how is it that they are going to anticipate the workforce and create internal structures so that issues of diversity and inclusion are a part of how the future workforce is handled. And they're thinking carefully about buying powers as the demographic changes occur. So this is a complex thing that has economic implications, but also has these implications that relate to justice. And it wasn't just these couple things. You know, after World War II, the GI Bill, there was big differences in how returning service people from World War II got different benefits based upon whether or not they were white or they were people of color.
And so the GI Bill discriminated against people of color?
The bill didn't, but its implementation did. How the actual decisions were made by the veterans, the veterans' offices and administration. The bill itself, no, but it's how it played out. Mm-hmm. So when you think about, at least the approach that we've taken is focused on three things. One is policy, public policy. We've mentioned a couple already. And another one is institutional practices. We've mentioned two already. One of those is how the practices of the Veterans Administration played out after World War II. And the other one is how banks actually made loans in 2000, around the subprime area, subprime mortgage time, 2008-ish. And currently, based upon that recent report, those are practices. So how is it that we pay attention to both policies, but also to the practices? And the third area is a little bit more complex. And it really looks at what are the things that, how do we talk about issues about race? What's the language and icons and images that play themselves out? And the traditional language that not just media, but we all tend to use is a language of blame. In other words, a little bit like what you mentioned earlier, if you don't make it, it's your fault. So that discussion leaves out entirely these policies that have created the different opportunity, access to opportunity.
I want to go back to the Social Security Act and the Franklin Roosevelt years. You mentioned before that the fair wage standards did not apply to farm workers back then or to domestic workers. And one other group that was kept out, and tell me what the history of this is, that if you were a tipped worker, if you were on the wait staff of a restaurant, you were kept out of what part of the Fair Labor Standards?
The minimum wage. In 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act was put into place, and it was great. It created a minimum wage. And there's all sorts of discussion about what is a fair minimum wage now. But it left out tipped workers. So Although some states, many states, have incorporated a minimum wage for tip workers, it's still typically less than the regular minimum wage.
Less. Were those workers predominantly people of color back in the 30s and 40s?
They were nearly all people of color. And even today, the federal minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13.
Which is nothing.
Well, there's been some really nice research that talks about, so what is it that, if you look at all the different occupations, inevitably, just about in every report, it's tipped workers who are at the bottom of that stack. So, and then in those places where they've been, where there's been local statute that's been applied, where tip workers are, you know, they get minimum wage, or even better than that, depending upon what city and what state you're in, it has made a huge difference to the quality of life, and it's had negligible impact on the economy in terms of the success of the organizations.
What do you say to people, though, that say, well, this did happen in the 1930s, they agree with you, but if you look at the changes since the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the kind of pushback, those kind of, I mean, you mentioned redlining may still be around under different, you know, name, but people that say, well, you know, we've had tremendous improvements since the 1930s when it comes to treating people of color equally. What do you say?
Well, there's this phenomenon that is described in when you think about the history of any of these kinds of efforts, and it really has to do with each time that there's progress, there tends to be retrenchment. So we've already mentioned a whole bunch of things that happened in the 60s. But it was immediately thereafter that the mass incarceration around the issues that related to zero tolerance around drugs occurred. And that ended up in incarcerating huge numbers of especially African-American males. If you look at the data, even in this report, and by the way, this report is has been done by this policy link group in about a dozen other cities and counties as well, so with much the same kind of data. So we're not different in that way. But if you look at this report, there's huge disparity on the success of what's going on in communities of color than in the white community. So one of the things, for example, and this was taken on not long ago by San Francisco County, they looked at how the counties and city, San Francisco City, fees and fine structure disproportionately impacted families that didn't have much money. Basically, getting back to that same thing, if you can't find $400, what are you going to do?
And these are fees and fines for
anything. It could be for a non-moving traffic violation. It could be for any number of things that any of us run into all the time. Your car got towed away, whatever that might be.
Yeah.
So if you don't have access to several hundred dollars, you end up potentially being put in jail.
It snowballs.
It does.
Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. The big elephant in the room that we haven't talked about in the past was Jim Crow laws and laws that enforce segregation. So what impact does that have today, you know, all these years after the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, you asked about you know, the progress. Well, that's another evidence of the retrenchment, that even though there was really substantial progress, and some of which we've already mentioned, that Jim Crow laws created a separate lived experience for people depending upon your race and ethnicity. And those have tended to diminish opportunity for people, especially things that relate to housing and employment and those kinds of issues. So they play themselves out over and over again. You know, if you look at the data, it's particularly distressing in my judgment in this report, and everybody has their own take on that. The evictions data, I don't know if you've seen that, Rob. But
I saw the map in your report,
The evictions data is, I think, in terms of, so what is it that might be done around these three things I mentioned, public policy, institutional practice, and changing the narrative. And evictions is one of those. So evictions are typically a consequence of not having enough money or some landlord-tenant dispute. And many times what happens is whenever there's an eviction hearing, the landlord is represented and the tenant is not. So that tends to be a really big power difference. And in New York City, they've seen that as such an important thing that they've said no more, that there will be, each side will have representation. That consequence of that is that their evictions are down. In addition to that, the eviction issues here, this state has a pretty tough eviction proceedings where the possessions of the family being evicted end up on the curb. And that's not the way it is in many states. There are several states that have it such that the possessions have to be put in storage for months or even longer. So all of these things, you think about it from the standpoint if you don't have much money and then you lose all your possessions, that just continues to exacerbate the problem. So in my mind, the evictions one is sort of jumps out and says, gee, this might be a space where something can be done. But the other couple that jump out have to do with issues that have to do with justice and law enforcement. So there's really differential sentencing experience. I don't know if you're familiar with the 2016 report from the Sarasota Herald Tribune, but they did a statewide analysis of differential sentencing, and it showed significant differences in terms of race and ethnicity. And that data shows up in this report, too, in terms of whether or not that's true in Pinellas County. And then the other piece of data that shows up has to do with is an organization called Measures for Justice, which is every 2 years they do an analysis of all 3,007 counties in the country and say, so how is each county doing around? And they have a whole series of yardsticks that they use. One of those is to what degree is somebody arrested for resisting, somebody charged with resisting arrest, and that's the only charge. That tends to be a judgment in the field as opposed to a policy. So in Pinellas County, and this is true in most places in Pinellas County, you're 2.25 times more likely to get that charge if you're black instead of white. So these are areas where there can be some work done, and that's, I hope, what will be happening as a result of this report coming out.
Well, we're talking about a new report about Pinellas County done by, it's an equity profile of Pinellas County. It's done by our guest, who is Tim Dutton, Executive Director of United Pinellas, Unite Pinellas, and the study was commissioned for the group, which includes Healthy St. Petersburg, the United Way Suncoast, and the Juvenile Welfare Board, and it's looking at the changing demographics of Pinellas County. By 2050, white people will comprise just 50% of the population, and what are the economic and social implications of that 30 years from now for the health of the county? And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. I want to ask you about one more thing before we go to the phones, and that is a lot of people who are low income don't have access to banks. And sometimes they just have cash at home. Sometimes they have to rely on these payday loan companies that you mentioned before. What impact does it have if you can't afford to maintain a bank account? Because if you're overdrawn, then you get that charge, that fee, and you can't afford to maintain your bank account. What happens?
Well, it's very expensive to not have money in this country, and that the amount of the cost of doing of life tends to play itself out in terms of things like if you live in a food desert, food costs more. If you don't have enough money to maintain a minimum balance, everything costs more. If you you know, the beauty of the places like the alternative financial services, like payday loans and those kind of things, is you know going in exactly what your fees are going to be. One of the problems with the traditional banking system is it's very unclear. You're fine as long as you maintain a minimum balance, but then in the fine print, boy, the costs are really high. So this is not so. You know, this is an area where a lot more work needs to be done at the local scale to see what the solutions might be. So that brings one other thing up, Rob. That one of the things that we believe to be critical in terms of generating any solutions at the local scale is that people who are directly impacted by the issues participate in the solution-making process. It's not uncommon that that's not the case, that in fact that, policies are generated by people who generate policies. It's really critical that there's a reality to the policies and to the solutions that are generated, and we think that is most effectively done when there's a real co-creation of those solutions, and part of that co-creation is not just by people who know the content, but people who know the context. So that's a principle.
All right, so how is this study that you've just completed and just published, how will you incorporate low-income people and people of color into this to make decisions in the future about what's best for Pinellas County?
Well, that's still a work in progress because this report is just starting to, I just got here today. So this is...
and the report just came out last week.
Just came out, yeah, that's right. So... I think the commitment is that as these things start bubbling up and as we start thinking in terms of what are the one or two or three things that we might focus on at first, because you can't do all of it. There's about 45 or 50 different indicators here. The participation by people who are directly impacted by the issue will be a part of that process. There will not be a solution or especially a policy generated without a truth testing, a ground truth testing, if you will, based upon the realities of the lived experience. So that's a part of what we intend to do moving forward. And a part of this will be invention because, as I said, this is unusual in terms of how effectively that's done.
Who are you presenting the study to? Who's looking at this to know that we may be in trouble if we do nothing between now and 2050?
Well, I would argue that it's not just about 2050. It's that right now we're missing opportunity to bring the skills, ability, gifts, if you will, of everybody to bear in our community. So it's right now these
days. You mean we're wasting talent is what you're saying?
Absolutely
right. We're wasting human capital.
Yep.
People have much more potential than they are living their lives through
exactly.
Now.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the calculation that we mentioned earlier from PolicyLink. That's to the tune of $3.6 billion in the Pinellas area. And certainly Hillsborough would be some number as well that's similar to that. So who are we presenting this to? At the meeting that was held where we released this event, there was sort of a broad range of folks. There were people who are impacted by it. There are organizations who are engaged and involved. There were foundations and philanthropy that was in present, and there was government there. The panel that presented around this issue had representatives had the deputy mayor from the city of St. Pete and the chair of the county commission from Pinellas County. So it had a real broad range, and that's what it's going to take to help make change happen.
What's the number one, and I know there are dozens of ideas out there, but what's one thing that, and I know you haven't done the process of asking these low-income people of color mm-hmm. what they want or what they need, but is there one thing that people should look at Pinellas County to make sure that these racial disparities don't get worse?
Well, the answer is there isn't one thing. And what we hope to do is one of the next things that we'll be working on is this is a point in time study. So it isn't automatically replicated each month, each year, each quarter, or whatever. So we're in the process now of putting together a website that will have a data component to it, so that as information is made available, and hopefully at scale down to some, in some cases, as small as neighborhood, we'll be able to start sharing. So how are things going? Sort of a can you hear me now kind of thing. Is there progress happening? Because part of this is to say, okay, we have this point in time now. So how do we mark progress or pay attention when progress isn't happening? So that's part of the long-term thing. I would add, Rob, that you know, we both know that the situation we're in now didn't happen overnight, nor will the solution. So we want to start thinking in terms of what are the local, and by that I mean municipal and county, and even state policies that can be implemented so as to make a change. And an example I mentioned earlier is evictions is a state policy issue.
Tim Dutton is here. He's with a group called Unite Pinellas, and this is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And we're going to take a phone call. Frank Knox, let's see, who is our phone producer today? I've forgotten. Oh, Jan Simpson is our phone producer today. Let's go to David in Clearwater. David, you're on the air. What's your question?
That was Frank. He has a very high voice.
Yeah, I was going to say. Sorry. Sorry, Jan.
Very pleasant demeanor, though. We're talking about voting.
No, is voting part of this?
It is one of the indicators in here, and I think that the caller raises an interesting question. What is the question you might have around voting?
Well, around voting, it is, and I don't like to say this because I've voted since I was 21, because that was the age when I started. But shouldn't we be concentrating on requiring that people that are entitled to vote?
Yeah.
All of the turnout for every election we've ever had, I don't think we've made over 50%, except maybe in Obama. Since after the Second World War, people just, the percentages just aren't there. They're not going out to vote. So less than 20% of the people in America are driving the wagon.
Yeah.
If you got 40% vote and you got 20% vote for one candidate plus one, they win. And then we say, well, we're a democracy and the majority rules here. Well, it hasn't ruled because we don't make people vote. We say it's a privilege and you should go do it. And I think the majority of people that do that are either African Americans since 1960 and white Americans that are old guys like me. 70 and plus, if there's some way to require it, I think people will pay attention and learn about the candidates, and then we'll get a real sense of the populace.
All right, David, thanks.
Yeah, that's it. I got other things, but you guys are talking and you're running out of time.
All right, David, thanks a lot. We got other callers too. David, thank you.
So David raised a really interesting point, especially in today's environment. The data, just to give a little clarity to it, the data is that in Pinellas County, the share of adults who are registered to vote in the 2016 general election. Let me get to the participated. The voter participation of registered voters in 2016, 79% of people who are white and 70% of people who are black. 2018, you know, was a non-presidential year. Those numbers are down for everybody. But so that's what the data shows. But one of the things that's going on now is that David's proposing that there be some mechanism for making it easier or required that you vote. And in fact, in many states, the opposite direction is happening. There are restrictions being put in place around voting, and they are in many of those states disproportionately impacting communities that don't have much money and communities of color. So there's a vigilance that we need to be paying close attention to in every state, including ours here in Florida, around voter. And, you know, we had this wonderful experience with Amendment 4 and Amendment 4 was passed by a supermajority. So clearly the concept of having fairness around voting is a big deal. It's a big deal for this state, and to some degree that we're used now around the country as an example for how big a deal that is.
And the legislature is trying to roll back the impact of Amendment 4.
Yep, and they're saying that you can't. Now think about what we just talked about income, that you have to pay off all of the fines and fees and all those things that you incur during the process of your incarceration and your term in prison, and before you can vote. So putting up barriers is a part of what's happening. And this is showing up at the national scale around what one of the Democratic candidates talks about in terms of you should never have your voting rights taken away.
Let's go to Jackie in Sarasota. Jackie, what's your question for Tim Dutton?
Oh, hi, Rob. Great show. Thank you so much. We're so blessed to have you. And my question is, what does your guest know about the policy of reinstituting banking at post offices? Just basic checking, savings account type of thing like we used to have many years ago.
I have to confess I don't know a lot, except I do read that that's still an idea that has been kicked around, frankly, quite a bit over the past half dozen or so years. I mentioned earlier that communities that live in food deserts struggle, and then there are many of those same communities that you're talking about that don't have access to any kind of banking. So the alternatives end up being very expensive alternatives. I don't know much about that, but the more available things are, like access to financial services, is a plus. So I would think it's certainly worth seeing whether or not. For example, we could try out a banking arrangement that would be at post offices. That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, the post offices are already in place. They're constructed. They're right there. Yep. Richard Wolf is the proponent of that.
Yep.
All right, Jackie, thanks a lot. What about bail bond reform? Does that show up in your report?
We don't have any specific data on it, but it is one of the things that, if you look at issues of equity around the country, it's one of those that is alarmingly is a big deal. And one of the things that has become clear is that I'm going to give you an example. In Texas, both sides of the aisle agreed on bail bond reform, but they are a very, very strong lobby, and they beat down that reform. So there are bail is an issue that really can be looked at. It's been, some states have really had significant impact in changing bail, and this state of Florida hasn't taken that on yet.
Mm. It can be costly for somebody that's being held for trial.
Yep.
And the family might not have that kind of money, or the defendant might not have that kind of money.
Absolutely, and my understanding is that there are certain costs. For example, if it's not a lot, if your bail's not real high, but it's sort of in the middle, it's hard to find any bail bondsman who's interested in it because they can't make enough money.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some real traps to this. And it ends up, you know, if you have to spend time in jail, that impacts your capacity to earn a living and your time with your family. So all of those things play out.
Tim, where can people see this Unite Pinellas study, the study that you paid for about the changes, changing demographics in Pinellas County?
There's a website that's called unitepinellas.org, and that the study and the summary, and I would commend reading both. The study is really the data, and it plays itself out in a bunch of graphs and charts. The summary starts talking about how is it that change might happen. So I would commend both to you.
All right.
So it's www.unitepinellas.org.
UnitePinellas.org. Tim Dutton, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF. Nice to meet you.
My pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
And if you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001 and record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow. Stay tuned. Coming up next, your hero, Mark Biro, will be here with his very unusual show. And thanks to Jan Simpson. She's been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lurie. Thanks for listening. This is 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg. We're going to take a break right now for 5 minutes and get the latest news from National Public Radio. And then right after that, your hero, Mark Biro, will be here live on WMNF Tampa.